From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Conservatives can feel marginalized on college campuses, especially conservative women. We'll hear from a group that works to address that problem. The opioid epidemic continues to do its damage in North Carolina. You'll learn some of the startling statistics. State lawmakers seeking to revamp North Carolina's school funding formula heard advice recently from a group called the Education Commission of the States. You'll learn why most states have abandoned the type of funding formula North Carolina still uses today. And an economics expert explains why government policies should be focusing on economic growth, not economic development. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The final footnote of decades-long legal battles over coastal land adjacent to Hammocks Beach State Park in Onslow County ended in December when the state released a master plan expanding the park. Now, this expansion comes 2 years after a family finally prevailed over the state of North Carolina for control of the land. Carolina Journal has been following this story for more than 5 or 6 years. Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins me now with an update. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
This story written by Don Carrington, who has been following the Hammocks Beach story for a number of years. Well, first of all, it sounds like a beautiful place. Lots of acreage and lots of things. A beautiful state park?
Yes. This particular parcel is 290 acres of a much, much larger area of land, and the land itself is on the Intracoastal Waterway. It was a hunting and fishing property at first, and since the early 1950s, it's been a resort and beach area. And we'll get into the history of that a little bit, but over the years it's fallen into disrepair in part because there were questions about who would own the land and how it would be managed and the like. And so finally, that's been settled. And not only has that been settled, but it looks like the state's not only going to take it over and expand the park, but it's going to preserve some of the more historic areas of that park as well.
The history is really interesting. I summarize it this way, really a David and Goliath story. Here, this one family in North Carolina literally having to fight the state of North Carolina year after year after year, going through court battles. Give us the background on how this all came to be, that there was such a dispute over who owned this land.
Well, this is one of these things that happened as a legacy of integration, which was a good thing. Now, it was maybe not necessarily as good a thing for this family as it was concerned. The property itself was given to the grandparents of the two subjects of our stories, John Turner and Harriet Hurst Turner, both of whom inherited the property from their grandfather and grandmother, who were caretakers of this land. A Dr. Sharp, who was a very wealthy New York surgeon, discovered this area in Onslow County back about 100 years ago. He liked to hunt and fish. He came down there and liked it so much. He met the Turners and bought several thousand acres for duck hunting. And he befriended the Turners and liked them so much that he essentially hired them full time to be caretakers of the land, to keep it up. And then the Hearst's grandparents served as cooks, hunting guides, mm-hmm. things like that when Dr. Sharp came down, which was quite frequently. And so they inherited the land from him. But they didn't want the land necessarily. What they wanted to do was they wanted to create a resort area for African American teachers because the Hearst grandmother was a teacher, and there really weren't any recreational facilities available for African-American teachers at that time.
This was during the segregation time. It was very real in North Carolina.
That's right. And so they didn't really have any facilities where they could go, where they had beaches with, you know, with changing houses and things like that. And so they wanted to make this property a really, you know, nice, well-appointed beach area. And so they gave the land to the State Association of Black Teachers, essentially, for that purpose. Well, civil rights comes along, segregation ends, and all of a sudden there's no more association of black teachers. And so there's no reason to have a beach property for that teachers association, which went away. And so that's when the legal battle started.
Because the family members then, did they essentially say, well, okay, since this black teachers organization doesn't exist anymore and this was given to our family, we want our land.
Right. That's kind of what happened. There was a corporation, a trust formed to maintain the beach at the time that Dr. Sharp died. And so there were joint interests between the Sharp heirs, the Hearst heirs, and this particular organization called Hammock Beach Corporation. And the idea was the corporation would maintain the property as a beach and as a resort. And if it couldn't, then it would revert to the state of North Carolina if the state wanted it. And if it wouldn't, if the state didn't want it, then the state would give it back to the Sharps and the Hearsts. Well, the Sharps didn't want it anymore. And so in 1987, because the trust was no longer able to maintain it, they had a few scout functions there and things like that. But really, it didn't get a lot of activity. It started to deteriorate quite a bit. And so what happened then was that the Hearst said, we would like to have the land back. And the corporation said, okay. Then it was a matter of a court proceeding of saying, does the state want it? And this was about in 1987, about 30 years ago. The state said, oh, we don't want it either. You can have it. But then there became additional legal battles about how the transfer was going to take place. And that went on for some time.
And this is the part that really is a head scratcher for me, Rick, because if the state says, okay, we don't want it, and the family says, okay, we do, end of story, one would think, but it didn't end for many, many years. So what happened?
Well, the corporation, again, divesting the property was a bit of a problem, and that took a little while. And then starting about 10 years ago, then Governor Mike Easley and after that, Governor Beverly Perdue decided that they wanted to actually have this land incorporated as part of the Hammocks Beach State Park, but they wanted to do so without paying the Hearst anything for it. They just wanted to take the property away from them, which they said they had the right to do because they were sort of the owner of fourth resort, if you will, if the property wasn't properly maintained.
That was litigated, right?
That was litigated. So the litigation took place, but on two separate occasions. In 87, once again, as I mentioned before, and again around 2007, the State Board of Education was given the opportunity to take over the land and said no until the Easley and Purdue administrations, using some attorneys from then Attorney General Roy Cooper's office, came in and said, no, we want this land after all, and we don't want to pay anything for it.
Now, the Hearst then said, hey, wait a second.
Right. They hired
– we don't care that you want this land. This belongs to us.
Right. They hired Raleigh attorney Charles Francis, who recently ran for mayor of Raleigh, by the way, unsuccessfully. They hired Charles Francis to represent them, saying the state had renounced the property twice. They went to a jury, and they won.
Now, tell us about the role of former Governor Pat McCrory in this.
Well, they won in 2006, okay, but then the Superior Court Judge Carl Fox said, no, this isn't the right outcome. So he overruled the jury. He allowed the state to actually seize the property, and the Hearst continued their lawsuit and their battle, and it looked like it was going to go to the state Supreme Court until the election of Governor Pat McCrory, whose officials started looking at this situation again. Charles Francis and the Hearst heirs give Carolina Journal's reporting a lot of credit for actually laying out their story and saying this was an injustice that was about to be inflicted upon this family through no fault of their own. And as McCrory's team said, okay, let's find somebody to help us buy this land and pay you. And they got the Nature Conservancy and some other groups in, paid $10.5 million for the land. And now the state's finally released a master plan for the park. And part of that plan is going to include restoring some of those old beach buildings and things like that, and retaining some of the history, and perhaps having an area that would be appropriate for walking tours to see what happened to for this that was supposed to be a nice resort for black teachers.
Well, this is just an amazing story about private property rights and the legal battle that this family, the Hearst, had to go through for year after year after year, fighting the state of North Carolina. Finally, during the McCrory years, they were able to take control of this, then sell it back to the state. They got their proceeds, and now it's going to be this really amazing park. You can read the updated story on the Hammocks Beach State Park and the legal battle of this family at CarolinaJournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick. Appreciate the update.
Thank you, Don.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. College students get exposed to a lot of ideas. Critics of the modern-day college campus say most of those ideas lean one way politically. Our next guest works with a group that offers an alternative. The group is the Network of Enlightened Women. Vanessa Rivera is Campus Program Associate for the network. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, what is the Network of Enlightened Women all about?
Right. Well, so the Network of Enlightened Women was actually founded about 13 years ago at the University of Virginia by our founder, Karen Agnes Lips. She saw that, you know, the Women's Center at UVA was not very welcoming to conservative women. And with that, she said, you know what, I'm going to start my own women's group. So she decided to start a conservative women's book club. From there, 13 years later, we have over 30 chapters across the United States where we really promote intellectual diversity and help our members really grow in their conservative beliefs, as well as get them connected professionally for life outside of, you know, the college realm.
So this started really with the idea of helping conservative women on a campus, then
yes.
Expanded to multiple campuses.
Yes.
As you're talking with these students and getting these chapters going, mm-hmm. do you see that there's a real need to do this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even trying to start chapters, schools are not very welcome to them. We've had multiple schools say, we do not allow this. Certain events that our chapters try to have or speakers, the dates fall through with the registration office or you know, it's just not very tolerant. We've had protests at multiple, you know, just events where these students, these young conservative women are trying to, you know, get the word out about certain policies or maybe just do a philanthropy event. And just because they think a little differently from their, you know, liberal, you know, associates, they are very much penalized and persecuted for on campuses.
You mentioned that this started in Virginia. Mm-hmm. There are multiple campuses. Mm-hmm. What's the presence of the network like in North Carolina at this point?
Yes. So actually, we have a couple schools. We have at UNC, UNC Charlotte, and I believe we also have one at Western Carolina University. And those schools together are doing amazing work here in North Carolina, and they're quite the close-knit little sisterhood here, and they work together to get events, and they support each other very much.
What are some of the things you do? I believe this started initially as a book club mm-hmm. and then grew. But what are some of the things that you do? It sounds like events, gatherings.
Yes. So we encourage our student leaders to have speakers. They can bring in multiple speakers from like Katie Pavlich, different maybe conservative women in government, whether they're from, you know, a school board to a representative to speak, you know, about their careers, their lives, as conservative women, what was it like to get to where you are? A lot of students actually do activism. I was actually a leader of a chapter before I was hired by NU. I started my own chapter at Florida Gulf Coast University, my senior year. So last year, and we did activism on campus. So we got a giant, like 8 or 9 foot beach ball the day after the presidential election, and we had people come sign and write whatever they wanted on it. And we had First Amendment handouts, and we kind of, you know, talked about how the First Amendment protects certain things. And I thought it was very necessary to have the day after the election because I felt that on such a liberal campus as Florida Gulf Coast is, you know, it may be nice to kind of hear everybody's different opinions and things like that. And I was actually shocked to see that there were more statements about love and acceptance on the beach ball, and that, you know, some said like love trumps, you know, hate and things like that, but there wasn't anything derogatory. We weren't treated badly, and I think people were shocked, weirdly enough, that we support, you know, free speech. And I was just, this is constitutional right. Of course we're out here. We want to hear your voice as long as it goes by the First Amendment. So we really encourage, you know, our students to take a stance on their campuses for their beliefs and don't let them be silenced. A lot of our students like to be op-ed writers, and we've had people published on Red Alert Politics, think Politico. One of our students, Emily Hall, she's the president of Harvard, was actually on Fox to talk about how bad the liberal bias is at Harvard University. So just
– So very busy.
Yes, we are very busy.
Very, very busy. We are speaking with Vanessa Rivera, Campus Program Associate for the Network of Enlightened Women, or you heard her use the acronym NU.
NU, yes.
NU. You have a special program that's being launched that has a hashtag for those who follow Twitter, hashtag She's Conservative. Tell us about that.
So She's Conservative launched last year, and it is the way we are trying to shatter the stereotype. And I've used kind of the analogy that sometimes people think conservative members of our society are like men that look like the little Monopoly man, right? The monocle, the top hat. And that is just not the case. And that women can be conservative as well. And that we come from all kinds of walks of life and ethnicities and different educations and different majors. And the one thing we all have in common is our conservative beliefs. So with our campaign, we've asked hundreds of students to submit their stories about why they are conservatives, who their role models are, and why it's so important to them to stay and be a conservative and speak out about their conservative beliefs.
How does a group like the Network or NU help these students deal with the pressure from peers on campus to either just be quiet or change their views? Does it help to have something like this that says, you're not alone.
Yeah.
Other people think the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know just from personal experience of having my table, you know, out on campuses and people being like, well, what are you guys doing here? And telling them who we are, they were like, oh, my goodness, I'm a conservative too, but no one talks about it. And our professors grade us differently and flunk us if we don't, you know, believe the same things. And having that network and that support, and, you know, everyone may lie on a different part of like a spectrum. But at the end of the day, we are holding intellectual conversations. You know, there's not arguments made. And there are plenty of, you know, chapters that welcome in, and we welcome, you know, women and men from the liberal standpoint to come and, you know, let's have an educated discussion. Some of our chapters actually like to have debates with, you know, opposing, I guess, clubs or organizations. And it's so nice to start a conversation. And that's all we really want to do, start a network of women who can host a conversation on their campuses where they can discuss things, look at things from different points of view, and tell their campuses, we need to have a conversation. You know, it doesn't need to be one way or another. You know, most people won't ever be swayed from what they're thinking. But let's have a peaceful conversation and let's talk about it.
Our time is running short, but if someone's listening and they are not already aware of a yes. Network of Enlightened Women chapter, wanted to find out more, wanted to perhaps even start one or help their child start one, how would they get more information?
They can email me at vanessa@enlightenwomen.org. Or you can also apply to a chapter or look up our information at enlightenedwomen.org. That is our website, and there's plenty of information there of how you can get involved with our movement.
Once again, that is enlightenedwomen.org. That is the voice of Vanessa Rivera, Campus Program Associate for the network, which goes by the acronym NU. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue to focus on the state's opioid epidemic. Section Chief Susan Consagra of the State Division of Public Health recently delivered some bad news.
Three people on average are dying each day from opioid overdose in North Carolina, and I'm sad to report that. Unfortunately, I'm going to very soon have to change the slide to four people a day because, as we know, overdose deaths are increasing and have been over the last several years. If we look across our state and at the counties in North Carolina, we see that the death rate is correlated with where we have had historically higher rates of outpatient prescribing of opioids.
The death rate isn't the only sign of North Carolina's problem.
For every one of those deaths that we have in North Carolina, we have about three hospitalizations, about 4 emergency department visits, and many more people reporting misuse of prescription pain relievers across our state. So we know that when we talk about overdose deaths, it's really just the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing. If you look back in 1999, we had about 100 overdose deaths in North Carolina, and now in 2016, we had about 1,300.
Republican State Representative Greg Murphy is a physician. He responded to Kitsagra's report.
Actually, the state of North Carolina and the nation as a whole since 2013 has actually decreased its prescription or its prescribing of opioids by about 15%. Unfortunately, we've continued to see the rise. And it now the number of overdose deaths related to prescribed opioids is actually leveled out, but we're finding much more of the heroin, people going directly to heroin.
Murphy sees another major problem. Too many people saved from overdose deaths fail to follow up with drug treatment.
Unless we get those folks into treatment, we're not doing anything. We're just continuing to spin our wheels. And that's one of our biggest challenges for our state. Our mental health system is broken, and we have to get folks into substance abuse programs if we're ever going to get a hold of this problem. I see that as really being the crux of this entire epidemic. We're working on the prescribing part, and I think we've made headway on that. We've worked on the synthetic opioids and getting them to be illegal. Our law enforcement are doing a great job, but if we don't complete that course of getting folks into treatments, we're not going to make any headway on this.
Kitsagra agreed.
Thank you for that comment, and couldn't agree more. And I think, as you point out, I think along with prevention, we have a whole generation of folks currently experiencing substance use disorders, and I think how we move them into treatment and recovery for that population is important.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative briefing on North Carolina's opioid epidemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are thinking about changing the way the state funds public schools. They heard advice recently from Michael Griffith, school finance strategist for a national group called the Education Commission of the States.
When we think of a high-quality system, we look at, is it adequate? And so when we say adequate, we mean, is it adequate to meet your state standards for all of your students? A lot of times I get asked, what is the adequate dollar amount? And it really depends on what your state standards are and what your goals are. And it changes from state to state. It also changes based on your cost of doing business. In some places it's higher, some places it's lower. So when you take a look at spending per pupil, you see it's all over the sort of the range in this country, going as low as about $7,500 per kid and as high as about $17,000 per kid. Some of that can be explained by regional cost adjustment. The highest spenders tend to be in the New England area and Alaska. Wyoming is the exception to that. And then the lower spenders tend to be in the West, where it's a little cheaper to educate students. Then we want to look at, is the system equitable? And we don't mean perfect equity. Are you spending the exact same amount per kid in every school district? No one does that. But are you relatively equitable? Are you spending based on some sort of balance between your highest and lowest, or your highest and lowest compared to the middle? Is your funding formula flexible? what, and we'll talk a lot about this with your formula, but the idea is the state, if things work best when the state makes the decision, allocates the funds down, and how to spend those dollars are left to the school districts. That gives them greater flexibility to deal with a lot of new needs and new programs that are out there nowadays in education. And that gets into the, is it adaptable? Is your system able to change as we're changing the way we educate kids nowadays?
Griffith next turned to North Carolina and its position allocation system. The state pays for a certain number of teaching jobs and other jobs based on student enrollment.
It was originally done so policymakers could know what are they buying. You could sit there and say, we are spending this amount right now in our state, and we know we have this many teachers that we're funding and this many superintendents and this many librarians and this many nurses. You can track that, and you know what you're purchasing. System made an awful lot of sense when you had all of your students attending brick-and-mortar schools in their neighborhoods, because you could track it, you could understand it. As you saw certain needs arise, maybe social workers, for instance, are needed in school districts, you could add that to the formula. But again, you'd be tracking it, and you'd be saying, we know exactly how many social workers are out there. So it's a very top-down decision-making process. It was not really the intention, but it was what ended up with in these types of systems, that the funding becomes rigid and districts don't have a lot of decision making or as much as they would under some other funding formulas. So what happens is, if you say, I don't need maybe one of these teaching positions, I need a librarian assistant and somebody to work in our lunchroom for security reasons, you can't necessarily do that under these types of formulas. So what that means is the state has to constantly go back and adjust different line items within these formulas to take into account rising or lowering cost or changes.
The system has benefits, but also problems.
I know you created greater flexibility within your system. Well, very often when you create greater flexibility in a position allocation system, you're actually making it more complicated and less transparent in some ways. And you're benefiting those schools that have very clever school business officials, and you're punishing those kids who are in a school district or school that doesn't have someone who understands the formula as well. And the example I always use for something like this is, when you have a position allocation funding system, every once in a while you'll make changes to it every year or two. As time goes by, each one of those individual changes made sense, but it'd be like a home over a period of time that you kept making changes to, and then one day you wake up and your home has 12 bedrooms, one bathroom, the kitchen is in the backyard, and there's a toilet in the living room. Each one of those may have made sense, but now you have a structure that does not make sense overall. And you're not the only ones who've come to this. All of the states that have had a position allocation system have kind of gone through the same process.
That's Michael Griffith of the Education Commission of the States. He says North Carolina is one of only seven states that fund public schools based on positions or jobs. Most states use what's called a foundation funding formula.
You start with the base or foundation amount. Theoretically, this amount should be, in a foundation formula, the amount that you need to get a general ed kid to state standards. I will tell you there are only probably three states that actually have their base or foundation amount based on that. The other 32 or so states have a number that the legislature could afford in that given year as their base number. So, you know, that really knocks out sort of the logic behind a lot of this. If your base number is not based on something, then, you know, you're sort of manipulating the whole system. The next thing you do is you do a student count. And when we say weights, that means if you feel that there's additional needs for certain kids, like English language learners, special ed students, at risk, poverty students, you provide them with an additional weight. So a special ed student might count as 1.5 students. English language learner might count as 1.25. And then you sort of multiply all those student counts by the foundation amount, and that gets you to a total funding amount. And then what you do is you add on, there are some things in these foundation formulas that you do not take into account usually, and that's transportation, capital, food services, and these are dealt with outside of the primary funding formula. So why did so many states move to this? Well, it's relatively easy to establish. Again, you've got a dollar amount per kid you can think about. If you want to provide extra money for different groups of kids, you can do that through a weight by giving them additional weights in their student counts. It's very flexible, and it's easy to adjust to the states and districts' needs. So if suddenly you come up with an idea of, you know, there's dual and concurrent enrollment where kids can get college credit, you simply say, okay, now you can spend your foundation allowance on that. You can choose to do that. Maybe instead of teaching a math course in your school, you can contract with the community college, and you can use your funds for that student for that course instead of a course inside the K-12 school. It provides districts with greater autonomy and decision-making.
Griffith urged caution if lawmakers change the funding formula but maintain state control.
I would say, though, if you adopt a new formula and you put a lot of controlling things like you have in your current formula, it probably isn't worth your transition. It probably isn't worth the time and effort. If you end up simply coming up with a new way to slice the pie and everybody gets the exact same slice, I don't know what the gain is there. So you spent a lot of political capital and energy on something that won't make actual changes in the way things are done. You'd want to look at this and make this transition if you think you could do it to make your system provide it with greater freedom and greater adaptability to a lot of the things that are going on nowadays. And if that can't be done, then maybe you step back and wait a couple more years before you do it. Again, I don't want to sound discouraging, but I've seen some states make this transition, and if everybody, again, like in Rhode Island, gets the same amount that they would have under the old formula, I just don't know what that gets you. It got them some bragging rights for a couple of years where they said we got a new formula, and then that sort of ends, you know, on the reality hits.
That's Michael Griffith of the Education Commission of the State. He's offering North Carolina lawmakers advice about school funding. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. We hear these two terms a lot. On the one hand, economic growth. On the other hand, economic development. Now, some people think that both of these terms mean exactly the same thing. But the John Locke Foundation's Dr. Roy Cordato says they couldn't be more different. He's here to explain why and why it's so important. He, of course, is the senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Let's start first with economic development, mm-hmm. because there are many, many localities, cities, counties who have people that they've hired to be economic development specialists. So
right.
What does that really mean?
Well, economic development usually focuses on trying to attract certain businesses to a specific location, to affect a particular outcome. Like getting a business to come or expanding one industry or another, improving things in a particular region or with a particular group of people. So economic development policies tend to be very targeted.
And there's usually a basket of goodies involved.
Absolutely. So, no. When I say targeted, I mean it's usually incentives. Tax breaks, direct subsidies, regulatory breaks, zoning law changes, all specifically meant to affect a particular outcome.
Now, on the other hand, what does it mean if someone says that they want economic growth?
Well, economic growth is something quite different. Economic growth typically deals with increases in statewide GDP. If we're talking about the state, gross domestic product expansion of output and job growth sort of across the economy, not for a particular business or a particular concern or a particular region. And typically also it doesn't involve – in fact, it's the opposite. It doesn't involve targeted tax breaks or targeted regulatory breaks or whatever. The policy approach is usually very broad, applying to everyone, right? Tax breaks for all individuals and businesses across the board, regulatory breaks across the board for bigger companies and smaller companies, not targeted, but sort of an equal opportunity approach with respect to entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship.
Roy, when you wrote about this, and you can read Roy's piece on this at johnlock.org, I thought this was really fascinating in your piece because you said not only is there a difference between these two in terms of economics, but you made a very good case that there's also a difference in simply philosophy and the mindset of how people view government. Explain that.
Yeah, there's people who espouse and really are concerned about economic growth. See the really accept Adam Smith's point of view that if you get government out of the way in terms of lower taxes, less regulation, out of the way of entrepreneurs, the economy will perform as good as it can. That's the and you will get growth and job creation, so on. On the other hand, people who tend to favor economic development do not trust markets. Their view is that we think there should be a specific outcome, and the market is not producing that outcome. Therefore, we need to redirect resources through the government to achieve that outcome, to nudge the economy in a particular direction. As I said in the piece, it really is viewed that, at least at some margins, government does indeed know best with respect to how market resources should be allocated.
Another thing that I think is really interesting, Roy, is that you make the point that some people who favor economic development will say, look, you know, we've tried that free market thing and it's really not interested. The market does not provide for people. It doesn't care for society, for the so-called common good. We hear that phrase used a lot. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to that argument?
Well, typically what they are saying is it's not giving us the outcomes that we think it should give us. Right. In other words, it said, well, you know, if the market was doing the right thing, this company would be locating in Kinston or whatever. OK, why do we think it should that it would be an efficient allocation, a good allocation of resources for that to happen? But it's not. So therefore, we have to nudge that company through to do that. But the point is that they're second guessing the market. There's probably a very good reason why a company isn't locating in one place or another or not coming to the state. And it very well might have to do with the fact that the people who favor economic growth, their policies are not being implemented. The regulations might be too high, taxes might be too high, and so on. I think what they're really saying is that the outcomes that we as bureaucrats think should occur, the market is not producing, which is not the same as the market is not producing what's best for society.
Roy, what is it going to take for people who are in positions of policymaking to understand that argument and to be able to realize that sometimes what you think is the right thing just simply isn't the way the market is going to work?
Well, I think what it's going to take is a better understanding on our part, our meaning those of us who advocate for the free market and believe that the free market and Adam Smith's invisible hand is the best way to go for making society better off. It takes, I think, a better understanding on our part and a better
better communication on our part. Look, there's a lot of economic development is wrapped up in special interests and cronyism. We use these terms. But a lot of it is just the fact that the people that fight for it really don't believe that they believe that the visible hand is better than the invisible hand. Okay. And so we have to understand our arguments, I think, better. And we have to be able to communicate them in a way that a skeptical public is going to buy it, which is not an easy task.
No, and in fact, we go through this debate at the General Assembly pretty much every session.
That's
there,
right.
Every, over things like every session. Incentives,
yep.
And
film incentives, and for different industries and different regions, and it's always the case. Solar and wind subsidies, whatever the case may be. You know, a fight over Amazon right now is part of this view. That the free market isn't going to work for the betterment of North Carolinians. We have to give, you know, lots of money to Amazon to locate here.
And in fact, we also hear a lot about the rural-urban divide, and this conversation comes mm-hmm. up. Well, we must somehow subsidize or incent companies to come to areas of the state that are not enjoying the economic growth that the metro areas.
No,
are.
That's exactly it's part of the whole story.
So, what do we say back to a lawmaker who says, "Look, you know, I need jobs in my community, and the market just isn't doing it"?
Well, I think some of it might. I think there's a couple answers. Some of them, look, might not be. What they want to hear. I mean, there just might be that particular location for whatever reason is not right for a lot of the industry. But also, I think if they need to look at their education systems, is the workforce that's being provided in those areas appropriate to the kinds of industries that are out there looking for places to locate? How are the roads? Okay, what's the infrastructure like?
Dr. Roy Cordato, senior economist for the Locke Foundation. Roy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.